The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
When Gooch gets back out into the pocket, like, I remember trying to practice this for about 6 months after I was nearly dislocated. He does it two or three times in the first half. It's sensational.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
The OTB Podcast Network with GetZetGo. Black Box Car Insurance lets young drivers bounce past high-cost premiums. Drive safe and save more with GetZetGo.ie.
OTB.
With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
7:30 this Thursday morning, you're very welcome along to OTB AM. It's Ger Gilroy and Owen Sheehan with you all the way through until 10. We'd love to hear from you. There's plenty going on in the world of sport. Loads for us to get our teeth stuck into. The return of Stephen Cluckson to training just minutes after DB had said he thought he had retired. The evidence certainly made a compelling circumstantial case. We'll see what Kieran Kilkenny has to say in the papers a little bit later on. Apart from that, there was a Titanic night last night in the football where at one stage, Owen, it looked like I was going to be walking in going, well, how do you like those English apples now? All they got to do is beat Hungary to basically reach the finals.
Are you not going to do that anyway? Is this German team really one that you and your bandwagon fear?
So in 2002, when the World Cup was on and Ireland was riven by the post-Saipan Civil War, the stings in and out of RT's World Cup coverage was an ad for MasterCard. They were the tournament sponsors for the TV. And they had the MasterCard logo is two globes, two balls in different colours. I think one's red and one's yellow. And they turned the two balls into puppets. And the only thing that I remember from that is, like, the two Dublin balls, puppets, saying, do you know you can never write off? And then they looked at each other and went, the Germans. And I was like, and 2002, that German team was not good. And we'd written them off because Ireland had been able to equalise against them in the group stages. And then they went all the way to the final, with Oliver Kahn producing this mad performance that ended up making him... Did he end up stealing the Player of the Tournament award from the real Ronaldo? I'm not sure. But certainly he was in competition for it. And so, you know, that was a team that you could write off. And this is the kind of a team that you could write off, particularly last night when they just completely fell asleep after they'd equalised. It was like, oh, this job is done. Thanks very much. We're at home. And who is this crowd anyway? Oh, they just scored again. Can they do that? Are they allowed to do that? How did that happen? So I'm not writing them off. I'm definitely not writing them off. I can't wait for this game. It's like, it's going to be brilliant. Look at all the ghosts that are already shuffling out on the pages of... This is like the immediate post-match reaction in England has been, oh, Jesus Christ. Imagine what it's going to be like after like 3 days of national psychosis, penalty shootouts being replayed, agonising misses from a few inches, dodgy goals looping over goalkeepers, offsides. Like, how many times... Do you have to watch the video of 1966 to expunge all of the other stuff that's happened in the meantime? A lot.
A lot. Like, it has the potential. I'm not sure whether it's the BBC or the ITV who has, the ITV says the dad here, who has the actual rights to the broadcast. But it's going to be one of the most melancholic British television moments of all time, you'd suspect, because, like, I mean, they've shown incredible form so far in dipping into the reservoir of 1996 content. They will dip right back into that reservoir over the next little while and just break the hearts of English people before a ball is even kicked, which maybe is a good thing. Like, I mean, I'm not sure did you catch the opening game against Croatia, but they had this montage of all the English disappointment over the past 25 years, and it was just three lines starting to play, and then it stopped, and then it started to play, and they literally played the song 12 times, I'd say, throughout the course of the montage. So I'm wondering, where do they go now from here? Where do the BBC go from here in order to find the right way to tug at the heartstrings of the English public? What piece of music from 1996 could possibly work in this instance? It's like, surely the well is dry on this front. We have seen everything. But I suspect maybe there's more to come.
What do you want to happen from this point forward? Stick your post-colonial inferiority complex in your back pocket. Stick your Schadenfreude away for a moment. What do you want from a football perspective? And then you can tell me about the Schadenfreude and the post-colonial inferiority complex revenge fantasy that you have going on. But from a football perspective, what do you want?
I guess the better storyline on a purely footballing level will be England winning and getting to the final, because I think England have a better team than Germany, and England have been better than Germany, I would say, overall in the group stages. Like, England have been average and Germany have been bad. with the exception maybe of the Portugal game where they were actually very good. But last night, they were very bad. And I think what England have shown is that they will grind out a 1-0 win against average teams by playing just a little less average than the team that they're up against because they've got much better players. Germany last night almost got beaten by Hungary. That would not happen to England, this England team, as far as I can see. So
did we underrate Hungary, though? Because like Hungary gave it all to Portugal until the last 15 minutes and obviously held their own against France, who everybody's like, oh, this France team is the greatest team of all time. Oh, look at this. They're absolutely amazing. They're on the verge of history. And then it's like, and last night they were pretty good, no?
Like, I guess so. And maybe we did completely underrate them. I guess maybe the France results probably Frank said. I don't know, to be honest. I don't know enough about this Hungary team to know whether or not they're any good or not. I watched them play against Ireland before the tournament started, and they were very poor on that night. That was their big send-off, and that was what we were judging it on. Their best player, Szoboszlai, was not going to the tournament, and we all said that, okay, well, the Hungarians are screwed without their best player, and they will almost certainly finish bottom of the group with 0 points. Last night, they'd almost qualified, so maybe they are a lot better, and maybe it's an injustice to Germany. But I think on the balance of things, England go into this game in better form than Germany do.
OK. And then from Schadenfreude, post-colonial inferiority complex, tell me, which point or how do you want the inevitable calamity that is impending for English football to unfold? Well, who's your favourite fall guy?
Well, I'm just thinking here that the BBC should actually just make the montage live. So when Germany have gone 1-0 up, that, like, I mean, they've already dipped into the reservoir of 1996 content. So I was just looking through the 1996 chart here for other stuff that could work perfectly for that montage. So I would probably be going for What Becomes of the Broken Hearted by Robson and Jerome for the montage immediately, and just have it ready at halftime. After Thomas Muller puts Germany up after 8 minutes and then they subsequently hold on to the lead for 82 minutes.
Robson or Jerome ends up in Game of Thrones, right?
It's a good point. I don't know which one, but that definitely rings a bell. Like right up there with the Ed Sheeran kind of comparison.
Oh no, this was the sidekick. He was you know, the wisecracking sidekick to the incest prince. What's his name? I can't even remember this. I watched every single episode and did a podcast on it at one point.
Very 2014. Let me cast my mind back.
The brother and the sister.
Yeah.
What are they?
Jamie and Cersei.
Jamie's sidekick was Robson or Jerome.
Right, okay. I did not know that they had such a significant role. I genuinely thought it was a cameo. Did Aaron Rodgers have a cameo as well in Game of Thrones?
Who?
Aaron Rodgers? Did that happen?
I think
Am I making stuff up?
Bronn.
Bronn, oh my God. I completely forgot about that. Right, okay. Well, he could just come out in his armour and, I don't know, slay the English dragon, and that could be how they do that. But just have it ready at halftime, basically, is what I want to see. That's the level of Schadenfreude I think we could all get behind.
Okay. From a football perspective, last night was amazing. And so I'll have no more of your nonsense about this tournament not being a good format or any of that kind of stuff. There might have been a few dud games along the way, but let's be having you. Come on.
Yeah, it was really, really good night of football. Obviously, the group of death ended the night the exact same way it started. If you're of a very functional mind, then you could say, well, what was the point of what was all this fuss about? But if you're of a romantic mind, then you're like, this is...
Or if you have a brain, go on. If you have an actual brain as opposed to a functional mind, it was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really unbelievable night of football, yeah. Yeah, absolutely class.
Very, very backhanded compliment there too. Very dramatic night. And Spain are back.
Yeah, Spain. The one thing that disappoints me about that the Spain game is that the Martin Dubravka thing is just going to be lost in the ether now. Everybody will forget that one of the great own goals of European football was scored last night, but because they got hammered in the end, no one will remember it. It wasn't important in the end.
I mean, it might have been important in terms of actually breaking their spirit when one of their best players ends up throwing the ball into his own net. The addition of the two own goals to the gloss of Spain's performance, I think maybe Ferran Torres' goal is going to get forgotten about in when the tournament wrap-up is finished. No one's going to be going, oh, remember Ferran Torres' first touch was a back heel running away from goal. Beautiful finish.
I do wonder if the Spain team are actually going to be the ones that kind of step up over the course of the next couple of weeks. Obviously everything in that side of the draw you can't really be sure of, but wouldn't mind seeing this Spain team go up against France in the quarterfinals, which looks like a relatively likely outcome. I know Croatia have also found their form, and that should be a brilliant last 16 game. But I just wonder what can a win like that do for a team when we've been deprived of a truly outstanding team. I think that's why, like, I think England are probably going all the way to the final at this point. England versus Netherlands should be a cracking semi-final. But I think if you just look at anybody who's been flawless in this tournament, you're not going to find a single team. So it's beautifully flawed what we've seen so far, and it's very, very hard to call who's actually going to come out on top now.
In terms of missing out, right, the England-Germany game would have been in Dublin if everything had been grand, or if we decided that we were going to be okay to take 11,000, 12,000 spectators. I think we're missing out. I think it would have been an amazing spectacle to see the Aviva full, or the Dublin Arena, whatever they would have had to call it. I would definitely have liked to have seen what would have happened. I mean, how many England fans would have come? A lot, I presume. Would they have been very well behaved? Would we have corralled them into Temple Bar and let them take their tops off and sack the city? Or I don't know. What would have happened?
That's exactly what would happen. I see Dan McDonnell last night saying that in an alternate universe, the English fans would be whitewater rafting before heading up to the Aviva for their last 16 game, which would have been good. Like, I mean, maybe we could have introduced them to, I don't know, the Viking splash tour or something like that, and showed them how terrible people once conquered Ireland, and they would have sympathy with the Irish plight. Maybe that could have been something that could have happened. But other than that, yeah, just put up fences around Temple Bar and let them throw their projectiles and get in the mood for a cracking game against their old enemy.
Maybe the thing to do is to give England every tournament so that the England fans don't get the opportunity to travel away. Is that how we fix the problem of English hooliganism when it comes to football around Europe?
Yeah, possibly. Possibly we would be deprived of our Michel Platini's amazingly loved intercontinental or throughout the continent tournament, which would probably get another run out, I guess, at some point in the future, given that this was in the middle of a pandemic and this has been a little bit affected. But the television spectacle has at times been excellent, and obviously the Germans are going to host the next one, and it'll be a tour through Germany, which will be a brilliant tournament for English fans included. So I think that this thing should probably be tried again in post-COVID times.
Yeah, in 7 years' time we should go back to doing this, and we could have England-Germany. What would England-Germany be like? Do you think it would be totally fine? Do you think there would be issues if it was being played in Dublin against the backdrop of Brexit and the row about the backstop and the border in the Irish Sea and the DUP issues? I mean, am I wrong to conflate all these things as being a culturally significant moment? Or is it just a game of football between two completely different countries at a neutral venue?
Yeah, no, I think that there would have been something. Now, of course, what Ireland's response to that being the petri dish of all of this would have been to send out the finest bartenders and waiters around Dublin to roundhouse kick the head off all the English fans who dare step out of line over the course of the couple of days that involved the England versus Germany game. So there would have been an apt response, but you can't imagine that things would have gone off perfectly. Like, probably a little bit of trouble, which would have manifested itself in grim exhibitions maybe of slight violence on social media, whether or not it would have escalated into like front page news or something truly horrific, I'm not quite sure.
An interesting thought experiment. The policing of it would have been interesting too. I'm sure a lot of videos would have been circulating of the riots in 1995 at Lands End Road.
Yeah, and I mean, there would have been, like as you point out there, there would have been an Irish element to this as well. This wouldn't have just been Temple Bar playing host to England fans versus German fans. There would have been, I presume, a lot of Irish people who would have actually had tickets to that
yeah,
last 16 game.
That's the thing. I think everybody, there would have been at least a quarter of the stadium filled with Irish people, who I presume would cash in. Tickets going for 10 times their face value already before the hype machine kicked into full overdrive. So that's what they were reporting last night, which means that it could get to who knows how much by the time the actual match comes around. So a reminder, at 7:44 this morning, OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock on the show this morning. Philippe Beauclair is going to join us in about 5 minutes' time. We'll run you through the sports pages at 8:10. James Skell is going to help us to preview the start of the All-Ireland Championship proper, really, in hurling, obviously the Munster and Leinster Championships. We have our TV picks with Sue Murphy coming at 8.50, and then at 10 past 9, Eamon Fitzmaurice, free from the pressure of being the Kerry manager, has been in conversation with you, Owen. The big news from the Gaelic football world over the last 24 hours or so was that the word on the street was that Cluxton had retired, but Kieran Kilkenny nipped that in the bud a little bit yesterday by saying, "I know, he's back training."
Yeah, he was out doing media yesterday, so Stephen Cluxton, by all accounts, is back in training with Dublin. I mean, he's been... there's a slight speculation, I would have thought, around his future. It kind of had reached ahead yesterday when David Brady was on here saying that he thinks that Cluxton is gone. I wasn't sure, like, because Mick Galvin had obviously been asked about it pretty much after every single game. I think after Donegal, he said he was soon to come back. As I pointed out yesterday, in Thurles, he said that he was soon to come back. But you just don't know in these situations. Like, I think that there's been a number of unexpected retirements managerially, and when it comes to players over the last couple of years, that seemed to happen at strange times. So you wouldn't have put it past him to have retired in such a way. But it does seem, if Kieran Kilkenny is coming out, then all is well, and he should be back between the posts over the next few weeks.
Yeah. Do you think he automatically gets straight back in the team? Is that what happens?
I think so. I think that if you've got Cluxton in, he has to play, because he's your captain as well, as much as anything else. He is your leader. He is the guy who's proven himself to be flawless at times in the biggest occasions. And I'd be very interested to see how they get on with a full season without him, because they've obviously gone through league campaigns and have been relatively beatable relatively mortal at times during league campaigns. But I don't think that's down to Cluxton's absence at all. I think that there's a number of different factors at play there. So one suspects that once Cluxton steps away, there will be a little bit of a betting in period for Evan Comerford, assuming he will be the man who gets the jersey. But after a season or two, it'll be like, okay, this is just Cluxton 2.0.
How was the Kerry hype meter when you and Eamon Fitzmaurice sat down to try and...
Not great, actually. I think I came into the conversation with greater hype. He definitely seems to be of the opinion that Dublin were just in third gear throughout the league and just wait for them to be back to normal. So I think the Kerry hype meter is directly proportional to the Dublin hype meter, and it feels that people have been sleeping on how good Dublin still are a little bit, which seems ridiculous to say, but that's certainly his opinion.
Do you agree?
Well, it's hard to disagree with someone who knows a lot more about football than I do, and he'll have seen this Dublin team maybe at their best.
That's kind of the whole point of the show. The whole point of this is that we get to disagree with other people. That's like, especially those who know way more than us.
Yeah.
That's kind of part of the joy of this.
Of course it is, but I don't know, like, the reason why I asked him, obviously, is because he'll have prepared for those Dublin games down through the years, and we're kind of guessing as to, like, what the intensity actually is of going up against him, or what is the best version of this Dublin team and when it was. Like, we could maybe take a stab that 16-17 was the best version of this Dublin team, and then others will say, well, look at how they creamed the opposition in 18 and in 2020 as well. So I just always find it hard to answer this question about Dublin. It is... Like, sometimes their dominance can actually be surprising, which seems weird to say, but sometimes they just steamroller teams, and we're like, why did we get into a position where we thought this might not happen? Like, when it came to maybe at times in the Leinster Championship, even, we start to talk ourselves into an idea that they may not be 20-point winners in certain games.
They're like, fever dreams, though, right?
Yeah.
That is a fever dream based on no evidence. What we've seen with this Kerry side, apart from last year, is that they definitely have the accoutrements and the talent and the brain power, and, like, they've come from the defensive mindset of the Fitzmaurice era, and clearly it looked like Peter Keane had gone back to that a little bit last year. We'll never know, because really it's hard to know exactly what was going on in that one championship game that mattered. And then on top of that, they've layered on really excellent forwards who are coming into something of a peak. Like, this isn't a fever dream, I don't think. I think that, you know, there's a realistic reason and evidence to back up the notion that Kerry can go toe-to-toe with Dublin.
Yeah, absolutely. There is absolutely evidence there, 100%. It just depends on how good Dublin are or not. And if Dublin in third gear was the Dublin we saw in Thurles a month ago, I think that spells trouble, to be quite honest, because I don't think Kerry were in third gear whatsoever. I think they'd nudged up to fourth for a lot of that, and maybe even slipped into fifth for a time in that third quarter. So that's the worry. And it all depends on, like, as much as you'd be like, yes, this Kerry team is good enough, which they seem to be, it does come down to the opponent they'll face in an All-Ireland final. And then there comes with all these all this paranoia from last season as well, which may be hard to escape or maybe is totally in the background. Like, I'm not sure if Fitzmaurice will go along with your idea there, just to move away from his defensive football, because he'd probably say that they weren't overly defensive under him, except for maybe the 2014 All-Ireland.
I don't think they've moved away. I think they've used that as the base and they've evolved. They've added forwards to it who are at a higher level than the forwards that he was able to call on. Now, forwards he were able to call on were pretty sensational at various stages along the way. So I'm not saying that they were totally defensive, but they were ultra defensive, particularly that year against Donegal, for example.
Like, they definitely approached that game using James O'Donoghue in a way that wasn't becoming of the O'Donoghue we'd seen all that year, for example, was one of those. I think against Cork in the Munster final that year, there was this brilliant swashbuckling performance that was right up there in any Munster final performance that they put in over the last decade, when he had, as you say, like a great combination of two eras, where you had Declan O'Sullivan and I know Colm Cooper was injured that year, but in 2013 he had those two flying, and then you had the new generation of Gainey and O'Donoghue who were outstanding from the off as well, and he managed to mould those two generations together pretty quickly and to become probably the second, third best team in the country around that time, even though it was clearly a team in transition. So, yeah, like 100%, if you're judging it in isolation, that is this Kerry team good enough to win in All-Ireland? All things being equal, absolutely yes.
Okay. And you didn't come away with just a more sense of realism. That's what we're going to get from speaking with Eamon Fitzmaurice. That's coming on your way at around about 9:10 this morning. It's 7:51. If you want to get in touch with us, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. We're very excited to let you know that OTB Sports will be broadcasting full live commentary of all 9 matches from the forthcoming British and Irish Lions tour of South Africa. There's obviously 8 games in South Africa, and a game this Saturday afternoon when it is the Lions, backbone by all of the Irish players, against Japan, fever dream fantasy revenge tour. If that's what you're looking for, that is your bag. 3:00 on Saturday afternoon. Brian O'Driscoll and Alan Quinlan are going to be alongside Neil Tracy on commentary for the 3 test matches. Devin Toner, Neve Briggs and Jack Carty will be among the co-coms for the warm-up games. And this Saturday against Japan, Andy Dunn is going to be in the commentary box alongside Neil for the 3:00 kickoff. That'll be live on Off the Ball on News Talk. And our coverage will be brought to you in association with Vodafone, lead partner of the British and Irish Lions. We're very excited about this. We're doing a classic game club special with Brian O'Driscoll. It's going to air tomorrow evening between 7 and 8 p.m. on Off the Ball on News Talk, and it is the second test from 2009. Now, I had forgotten we were doing this until after all the football last night, so I stayed up late to watch it. And I don't know how you felt after that game, Owen, but I was pretty... I hadn't watched it back since the actual game itself, and I remembered at the time being somewhat appalled by it, but I came away with it going, that might be the nastiest, most horrible, most grotesque sports team that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Every single aspect about them is, with the exception maybe of John de Villiers, who seems like a very nice man, who went off injured, but like almost no redeeming feature to them.
Like Schalkberger, first minute of the game, putting his
15 seconds in. And he's picking the eye out. He's literally got Luke Fitzgerald's eyeball on a string, and he's, I'm going to eat you now, Luke. And they're like, oh, it's a yellow card. Maybe yellow? Not sure. Oh, yeah, give me yellow.
Yeah, the assistant referee goes to the main referee and is like, it's at least yellow. And he's like, understood, yellow card. Rather than like conversation around, so is it like a red, do you think? Like, did he see the finger go into the eye? Moments later, then O'Driscoll then takes on Victor Matfield in a nice little tussle. So there'll be plenty of memories to get into in that one tomorrow night.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to grim yourself out about rugby and the state the game was in at that stage, but also if you want to be kind of gloriously entertained the way that you would have been in the Roman Colosseum as the lion mauls the human being, then you need to it's on YouTube. 7:54 this morning. If you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. I'm delighted to say Philippe Auclair is with us. Philippe, good morning to you. How are you?
Not too bad. Thank you very much. Good morning to you too.
So the group of death was nearly the group of death, and ultimately all the teams who we expected to come through came through, but not in quite the rude health that we might have anticipated. Where are France now, for example? What do you think about where they are?
Probably in a better place after last night's game than they were before in some areas. Still questions to be asked and which are being asked in France about some of the tactical choices, some of the personnel, but I think more or less they are more or less where we expected them. It's not entirely working. France has played perhaps two good halves, you could say. I mean, one good game against against Germany, certainly first half when they were competing, mastering things, and then managed the game extremely well. Against Portugal, it was rockier, but that was expected. You know, Portugal had a much more aggressive team than the one they had selected for their first two games. Obviously, there's a little bit of needle between the two nations, as you know. There's a long history of rivalry between those two teams. Last of which, of course, was the 2016 final. And also, Deschamps has been changed his tactical system for that game, went from a 4-3-3 to a 4-2-3-1, put Tolisso in a kind of false winger role, which didn't quite work, but all these reservations put aside, the fact is Benzema scored twice, and the fact is that Paul Pogba confirmed that he truly is one of the world's best midfielders, at least when he's got the French jersey on his shoulders. So I think more reasons to be pretty optimistic, apart from the fact that the half of the French draw is pretty nightmarish, isn't it? But otherwise, I think satisfaction at the job, pretty well done.
Can we tease out some of the issues around the tactical side of things in terms of the criticism mm-hmm. that Deschamps is facing? What are the issues and why is it not quite working at the moment?
Well, I think when you look at the game against Portugal and you look at where the threat was coming from France, and when you think of the amazing attacking potential that the team has, you'd be left a little bit frustrated at the lack of clear-cut chances created even against, you know, obviously a very good Portugal team. But by using somebody like Corentin Tolisso, who's a genuine midfielder, as a kind of winger, or as I said, false winger, we call them in French, on the right-hand side, it means that on that particular side of the pitch was basically, we didn't create anything there. And I still think that we are trying to find a way to make the Mbappé, Griezmann, Benzema triangle work properly, in particular for me when it comes to Antoine Griezmann, who is a superb player, who showed it against last night, but we are not creating enough chances. Even with such a wonderful array of attacking talent, and it's left to Paul Pogba, which he does very well, to have these long passes, which he does very well, like the one which led to Benzema's second goal, which is absolutely magnificent, by the way. But it's a little bit, you know, we're waiting for more from Kylian Mbappe in terms of the end product. We're waiting for even more from Antoine Griezmann, whom I think plays a little bit too far back. I'm not the only person to think that. And honestly, the way that the French team was organized against Portugal explains a good deal about that. I mean, this 4-2-3-1 is perhaps not the right configuration. But, you know, it was a try. It worked. It could not have worked. But the qualification was assured, of course. Some people would say that it would have been better to finish in second place anyway. So there are still areas in which there is work to be done and progress to be made, certainly for France.
The 4-2-3-1, Philippe, it may not get the best outcome for the team, but does it get the best out of Paul Pogba?
I think it was pretty good in the 4-3-3 in the first two games.
Sure. Yeah.
And the other thing as well is that if you imagine, and I think it is probably something we'll see more of as the tournament progresses, if you see in the role of the right winger, so to speak, or the right attacking midfielder, somebody like Kingsley Coman, who came on and immediately had an impact rather than Corentin Tolisso, probably the system, I think, would be more efficient. But France's 4-3-3 with either Rabiot, Tolisso and Pogba and Kanté is in some ways more balanced. And France actually created more with that particular system. But it's a work in progress. And I think that when it comes to, I mean, the fact as well of having, sorry to come back on that, but on the right-hand side, the fact that Jules Koundé was actually selected ahead of Pavard to create a threat on that right flank, which was had been thought beforehand, not to carry enough of this threat. And it didn't work. The relationship didn't work. So if this is put in place and functions correctly, then you will see a France which is probably more in tune with what Didier Deschamps is expecting. And I think that the one thing we have all got to say is that they were a bit frustrating. They've been a bit frustrating at times. The tempo has been a bit pedestrian. But if you look at the, I would say, the last 30 minutes of the game against Portugal, you would think that France is actually starting to rev up and going through the gears very, which is the way that Deschamps usually does it in tournaments.
Like that is the thing, isn't it? That the first game against against Germany just felt really significant. You have to win your first game to put yourself into that comfortable position. So, I mean, like they go back into must-win territory again from next week, Philippe. So you'd expect them to get back into that mode of the first game.
Yes, and if you look at their opponent, in a way, I mean, it's not no disrespect to the Swiss, and this tournament has already proven several occasions that to talk about lesser teams can be a bit dangerous. On the other hand, logic has been respected very often, and in this case, you would expect France to go past the Switzerland team, which has, I mean, I'm trying to remember the last time the Swiss beat Les Bleus, must have been quite a while ago in a major tournament. You would imagine it's a perfect stepping stone for the quarterfinals, and then you can carry on this process. Afterwards, it becomes a little bit more complicated when I look at the draw. But yes, the signs are good. The team will be reassured by its performance last night. I don't think they will. They will be super focused, as they always are when it comes to meeting the Swiss. The France is not a team that makes the mistake of underestimating its opponents, like Germany, for example, has done. I mean, they're in a good place at the moment, and I must say I'm feeling much more optimistic today than I felt when I first talked to you before the tournament started.
What's the reason for the change in optimism?
Because I thought this group was a horror, and I was dreading that first game against Germany. I had always said that the game in Hungary would be extremely difficult, and it proved to be, if only because they were playing with genuinely 12 men, the Hungarians, and that after a whole year of COVID, playing in an arena full of 62,000 spectators would be quite a challenge, and it proved to be quite a challenge. And I thought the game against Germany could go wrong, and the games against Hungary could go wrong. So you can imagine what my thoughts were, that if after two games we're in a bad place, then all the criticism that people are waiting to unleash at the French back home will be unleashed. And people will say, you should have been taking Benzema to the tournament, and you should have put Giroud, and you should have done this, and you shouldn't have done that. And in this case, I think yesterday's game as well, this is another reason why I feel optimistic, is that yesterday's game and Benzema's double will have quietened a lot of people, a lot of apprehensions, and a lot of people, even if I have to say, and I hold my hand up here, that the penalty which gave Benzema his first goal after 5 years was an absolute farce, but that's a different matter altogether. We'll take it.
The form of Kylian Mbappe is something that obviously the whole world is very interested in. Pre-tournament, we were wondering if this was going to be him stealing the tournament and putting the team on his back. It hasn't quite happened like that.
And
you've certainly been talking about this very consistently, about just there's something a little bit missing at the moment from the unburdened and the free-flowing Kylian Mbappe that we had maybe anticipated.
Yeah, and actually, particularly last night, was not particularly good, was he, in a big, big game. I do think, and I know that many people are obsessed about tactics and stats and things, tell me that it's not the case. But I do think that what's happening out of the field, is as important as what is happening on the field. And you can see it with Harry Kane as well. Players whose future is in the balance, especially at a time like now, always have a problem focusing 100% in tournaments, always. And not consciously. I mean, Kylian Mbappe, when he's there, listening to the Marseillaise or seeing the Marseillaise, he's not thinking, should I stay at Paris Saint-Germain or go? That's not the way it happens. It's just the fact that they are not completely 100% engaged all of the time with what is happening. And it can show. There is also an element of he playing with PSG as Kylian Mbappé is not the ideal preparation for playing with France in an international tournament. The level of opposition that Mbappé faces week in, week out, except in the Champions League, is quite poor. He doesn't have to overstretch himself. Also, he's working next to Neymar. It's a very strange, it's like a bit of a circus act at times, if I'm absolutely honest. But suddenly he's in this setup which is completely different, and which is not necessarily geared towards making him the focal man. But he's so good, he's so smart, so intelligent, that I think it's another of those cases where you will see him grow through the tournament. I mean, remember in 2018, it's only as the tournament grew, I mean, progressed, that we started to see the real Kylian Mbappé. And actually, you would say he kept the best for last. And it perhaps has to do with his style of play. It perhaps the way we haven't been very positive. If you look against Germany, we did all that was needed, scored a goal, and basically closed our shop, shut up shop. Against the Hungarians, we created loads of chances against an opponent which we were expected to beat quite easily, but then we were shaken a bit. And against Portugal, the main axis was not the, we'd say, for example, Lucas Hernandez, Kylian Mbappé, or it was Pogba, Benzema. And we haven't played to his strength yet. He hasn't had the space either in which to exploit his space fully, apart from a couple of occasions against Germany, perhaps. So all of these reasons, plus the fact that there is a certain amount of unease, I wouldn't say turmoil, but unease about his future, explains why, or is an attempt at explaining why we haven't seen the Kylian Mbappé we all know is there in this player. But we'll probably see him later on in the tournament. That's the way it goes with him.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting. The other big storyline from last night, Philippe, is the setting up of a classic in the last 16. So how ready are you for 4 or 5 days straight of England versus Germany build-up?
I know where the off button is on my television, so I'll be absolutely fine. But it will be unbearable. It will be unbearable. If you think how the build-up to the England-Scotland game was, that was bad enough. Now, to the England-Germany game, my goodness. Is it 5 days, you've said? Oh, my goodness, that's a long time. I'm looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to it. It's genuinely two teams that have no idea what they are and what they can be. So, and we're looking at every game of their tournament for a kind of response. And Germany was bad, brilliant, really bad. Brilliant next time, we don't know. England is very good, not so good, mediocre, quite good, you know, within the same games.
Yeah.
So we have no idea what's going to happen. But yes, it's the build-up is going to be interesting, especially in the current climate in Britain at the moment.
Well, that's the thing. So this game was supposed to be in Dublin, and it could have been Germany versus England with the Brexit backstop and the DUP issues all playing out on the streets of Dublin with the Irish Guards kind of, you know, daring the English hooligans to go. I mean, look, we certainly are thinking about what the alternative universe might have been in that case.
Yes, absolutely. Are we better off in the new configuration? I'm not too sure. The fact there is still the amount of people who can go to the game at Wembley at the quarterfinals is, you know, does change things somewhat when it comes to. I say Wembley. Yes, it is Wembley. Sorry, I'm still trying to work out this draw. But the fact it is Wembley, we're going to have, 22,000 inside because the number of spectators is only upped from the semis onwards. So. It's going to be a long, long few days. And I don't necessarily think it's going to be that bad in the streets or in the between the fans. it's more in the media that the battle is going to be fought, and in the British media, I should say, much more than in the German media. I'm not looking forward to that. That's the least I can say.
It's interesting as well, Philippe, that we thought that throughout this tournament, when it came to some of the off-the-pitch discussions, everything would have revolved around taking the knee. And over the last couple of days, things have changed considerably with the UEFA barring of the rainbow lights on the, yeah. the stadium in Munich. Obviously, it was just amazing to see Goretzka's celebration last night with the love heart. And obviously, he's been so well spoken about his role as a sports person over the years on a range of topics, from race to sexuality and a whole other bunch of things as well.
This was come with a quote of the tournament.
Say that again?
He's also come with a quote of the tournament.
Which is?
Which is when Germany, which is, it's great to be in a country of 82 million potential national team selectors than 82 million virologists.
Yes.
Which is utterly brilliant. But he's Leon Goretzka. He's a superstar.
And a kind of a brilliant sort of slap in the face to UEFA as well, that celebration last night.
Yeah, absolutely. Well deserved. Bravo. The worst own goal that UEFA could have possibly scored. I think the time when UEFA were everybody's darlings after what their resistance, or so-called resistance to the Super League project, is now lost in the mists of time. They've managed to absolutely ruin everything with great virtuosity, I must say. Their statement yesterday, in which they attempted to explain their decision not to say yes to the request of the city of Munich, was a masterpiece of contradictions, because they basically said that on one hand, we acknowledged the fact that the rainbow illumination would not be a political gesture. I mean, we could discuss that. I personally think it's a political gesture, but a good political gesture, but that's a different matter altogether. But we recognize it's not a political gesture, but our decision was political. You think, well, hold on a minute. So you're telling us that we can't do this because it could be deemed as political, but you've taken a political decision to placate the regime of Orban. And actually, in Hungary, are you aware of the fact, UEFA, that a large proportion of people do not agree with the anti-LGBT policies of Mr. Orban? Are you aware of that? No, they're not, obviously. So it's a massive own goal scored by UEFA. And in a way, I suppose, sometimes you've got, again, to be the optimist rather than the pessimist, and say that the very stupidity of their actions will have put the spotlight even more firmly on the issue that illuminating the stadium in rainbow colors was about. So they've succeeded. So maybe thank you. I mean, as you said, the Goretzka gesture, which has been shown all over the world, will probably have an even bigger impact, because there was nothing like, we're going to, in a way, follow a trend or respect a movement which is shared by everybody. No, this was very much, I am telling you, you guys, that this is right. And that is much, much more powerful.
In a way, that's true. Probably most of the world wasn't paying attention. We should have been paying more attention to what was going on in Hungary. All of a sudden, far more people are galvanized to try and support the LGBTQ plus community in Hungary and are exercised about this. And you know, maybe that's the impact that we all needed, a little bit of a jolt that we needed.
But perhaps, and the fact as well is that the people in Hungary who are fighting against the imposition of those draconian rules and discrimination will have been heartened by the response to that. And that is also a plus. So again, it might be, we say, un mal pour un bien, something, we say in French, something bad, but it in the end produces good. And, you know, let's hope we take it from there.
Yeah, Philippe, as ever, merci beaucoup. Philippe Auclair there, and getting a lot of love in our comments at the moment. Will says, Philippe, one of the best. Auclair knows his stuff, one of the best around. UEFA are some disgrace, lads. LGBT rights for the win, says New Holland. POC says, both England and Germany have brittle defences. England have shored this up by being most negative. Muller is, however, finding a bit of form in front of goal. Is it destined, is it writ that Thomas Muller is going to be the one that slays England at the weekend? I don't know.
Yeah, potentially. All this noise around England, like it is incredible, really. And you have to say that when they eventually get over the line, it will be an added achievement because of all of that. When we just think about what the next couple of days are going to be like, it's next Tuesday actually, so you've got a whole weekend where you're watching games and you're just thinking about England Germany. Your eyes are on Italy Austria, but really you're thinking about England against Germany, and that goes for everyone. It's going to be pure theatre. 5 o'clock next Tuesday, regardless of what happens. If it's a Bourne it all draw, then we get tantalisingly close to penalty shootout. Whereas if it's a classic, then it's a classic and we win. So no matter what happens, 5 o'clock next Tuesday, football is the winner.
OTBM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. It's 15 minutes past 8. James Gale is standing by. We're going to talk to him about the hurling championship. We'll also bring you through the newspaper headlines right after these.
OTB AM.
Right, we can run you through the newspaper headlines this morning. We'll start with otbsports.com. Goretzka sends clear message as Germany dump Hungary out of Euros. So he's making the love sign in the general direction of the Hungarian fans. And there's a brilliant picture from the other side where there's three black t-shirted Hungary fans who are looking very depressed as he runs towards them celebrating. Euro 2020 permutations, who plays who in the last 16? I mean, did we talk enough about the fact that Ukraine are still in the tournament? Did we talk enough about this? Yeah. Did you know that?
No, I'm only joking. So
according to Marca, anyway.
And according to the data that I have at my availability here, it looks like they're playing Sweden.
Yeah.
Which is a fixture list, yeah.
I mean, if you're Sweden, right? You're Sweden, so you've got to play Ukraine, who are rubbish. They were absolutely rubbish so far, right? And then you play the winners of England Germany for a place in the final, in the semi final,
in the semi final.
So the semi finals are all known as well. Of course, they are,
with revenge at stake for the Swedes after 2018 as well.
Not
in Wembley is a key thing as well. The quarter final.
It's in Rome. If you make that. And if you win that game, it's like the Dutch or the Czechs or the Welsh or the Danes.
Yeah.
Sweden-Denmark semi-final is not off the cards here at all. I know on BBC they were talking about the possibility of an England-Wales semi-final. But like everybody's looking at those semi-finals going, Czech Republic versus Ukraine, semi-final, thanks very much. That's what the Czechs and Ukrainians are thinking. And like, weird things happen in tournaments. You can nil-nil your way now all the way to the title.
I think that's what a lot of people forgot last night as well, when people were talking about England getting on the easy side of the draw. Like, Germany probably looked at that side of the draw last night, which includes England, and said that's the easy side of the draw. Like, people, I think, would prefer to play them than Belgium and Italy and France and maybe even Portugal at the moment. So, I wouldn't be overly with you on the whole Ukraine thing. Like, I mean, obviously they're not in the top 10 teams in this tournament, but like, they were pretty good the first night against the Netherlands, got their win, and here they are in the knockout stages, a couple of good attackers, and Shevchenko has them playing good attacking football. I think Sweden and Ukraine could actually be one of the better games actually in the last 16, because there's so much at stake for them both. To get into a quarter final in this tournament would be massive.
Was it Des Curran pointed out? I'm not sure, it could have been somebody else, that it's long forgotten now, but it was Shevchenko's Kiev side who were beaten by the odd goal in 7 by Bayern Munich in the 99 semi-final. I had completely forgotten that. That would have been how history would have been different. The London Times there, it's the Germans next. That's the picture of Goretzka with his hearts in the general direction of it. United landing 77 million Jadon Sancho. Not good enough for this England team at the moment, but good enough to be a £77 million player when your cluck's in. This is the back page headline on the Mirror. Kilkenny claims Blues most decorated man is making a timely return. So he's looking for his 600th Leinster medal this year. Stephen Cluckson has returned to training, according to Kieran Kilkenny, amid mounting speculation. So that would suggest he's actually back at training and good to go. Dutch and Go is the back page headline on the Star. Cluckson's training comeback, and United an £85 million bid for Sancho. They're the story there. So they're all essentially the same. London calling for the Germans. London calling is the front page headline on the Mail, and of course also on the Examiner this morning. Cluckson back in training with the Dubs, says the Irish Independent. And there's a really interesting story here from Roy O'Connor. It says Lions tour heading for a region of catastrophe. The Lions are heading to a region on the cusp of a COVID-19 catastrophe as South Africa braces itself for its third wave of the pandemic. A leading medic has warned that the situation in the Gauteng province, which includes Johannesburg, where Gatland squad will arrive and play their first four matches, is getting more and more worrying by the day after 10,800 new cases were reported in the region yesterday. 6,000 patients are in hospital. And then, as you heard last night on Off the Ball on News Talk, it is Killian O'Connor is the headline in your tab of the morning. James Horner admits he's planning without Killian O'Connor for the 2021 Championship. He told Joe last night that he's out for the foreseeable, so it seems pretty serious. And then the front page headline of The Guardian today, police officer convicted of footballer's manslaughter, and it's a picture of Dalian Atkinson, as I definitely remember him, in that cool old Villa top with the laces when the laces were all the thing. And what a vital force of nature Dalian Atkinson was as a footballer, and what a horrific way it was for him to die. He was tasered for 33 seconds and kicked in the head by PC Benjamin Monk, who yesterday was convicted of his manslaughter. The first British police officer in 35 years to be convicted of manslaughter while on duty. So a horrific end to Dalian Atkinson's life, and football fans will remember. He scored an incredible goal against Wimbledon. Look it up, check it out on YouTube, and hopefully that's how people are going to remember Dalian Atkinson in the future.
Yeah, just a couple of other things to go through this morning. The Leon Goretzka thing is interesting because people are kind of like digging back into Leon Goretzka being just a really top guy over the past 12 hours or so. There's like a couple of various different elements to this. Philip Lahm, in his autobiography recently, spoke about the idea of a current footballer coming out as gay and said that there is a lack of acceptance in the world of football and in society in general. He talked about Thomas Hitzlsperger, who obviously announced his sexuality after playing. And I guess we're talking about this in the context of the NFL as well this week. And Lahm said it was prudent of him to do so. And then Goretzka kind of came out around that time and said, I would encourage everyone to assure them of my support and still understand if they don't dare. My hope is that players will come out in my active career as well. When it comes to such issues, our society is often much more advanced than sport. And last year then, there was a situation where he urged his Twitter followers to follow the official account of the Auschwitz concentration camp memorial, and had this quote where he said, Fritz Walter once said that all national players are foreign ministers in shorts. I think the saying is very good. We players should use the great attention we get to raise awareness of such issues. It was sort of fitting that he was the man who found himself with the winning goal for Germany last night to deliver such a celebration. On a night when we had a protester on the pitch, of course, who ran on with the rainbow flag, which, of course, we weren't shown on television. But if it was, obviously there's a bit of a contradiction there, given that we saw the Christian Eriksen thing in clear colour a couple of weeks ago, but this protest was airbrushed from our TVs, but obviously picked up on social media and went fairly viral, to say the least, last night.
Yeah, the Viva was lit up last night to celebrate Pride. These pictures here have been doing the rounds. You can see them there. Viva also backing the hashtag Lace Up With Pride campaign to show solidarity with the LGBT plus community. You can buy the laces. They're £4 in Intersport Elvaries, and it supports the Belong to Youth services, who provide support to LGBT plus young people in Ireland. And it's a campaign that we're totally happy to support and get behind. You can see our laces in the corner there. You can there, yeah, over our shoulder here. So that's the crack with that. A reminder, OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with new and improved razors. It is time for us to turn our attention to hurling. I'm delighted to welcome James Scale back to the show. James, the week of a championship like this where it's beginning to get serious, the training has all been done. What's it actually like to be involved in a camp where you're hurtling towards the championship and things are getting real?
How are you guys? It's very exciting. I know I'm a country boy at heart here, but it's a bit like when you let cattle out of a shed at winter. They go jumping their leap, and it's kind of the way it is in training, let's say, in the last week or so, just in preparation, because everything has culminated this week. So when you get your winter programs back in a standard year, should I say, in October and November, and you start into the gym and you're running in the dirty nights, it's pouring rain down top of you, and you're basically miserable. All that's in your head is the championship week. We say that keeps you going as such. And I suppose guys have been lucky in one sense that the league has been so close to the championship this year. So they've had a run of games prior to the championship and have a good bit of practice. But everyone's excited, like everyone's looking forward. There's this touch of nervousness too. Like you obviously have guys who are guaranteed to start on the team. You know, most teams probably have maybe 10, 11 guaranteed starters, and there's probably 8 or 9 guys who were vying for the last 4 positions. So those guys are kind of nervous, trying to do everything right. They're looking over at managers to see if they're looking at them. They're waiting to see if they're going to come over and talk to them for a second to announce that they're going to be on the team, he says. So there's a touch of nervousness for some, but mostly excitement for most.
The presumably from a player's perspective, there's not really much you can do to alter the manager's thinking at this point. It always seems to me like managers have a bit of confirmation bias going on, and they need to have had in their head most of the big decisions made a couple of weeks back. And yet at the same time, they need to keep everybody on their toes to the point where everybody believes they still have a chance.
Yeah, and that's the issue as well. Like, that some managers, let's say, some are better than others, should I say, at that. And in my experience, that has been the case, whereby their management skills have been impeccable, and they've been able to keep the 30, 35 guys all in sync and going in the same direction without creating any much of a division between, let's say, the starters and the guys who are on the fringes. And let's say when management is not going well, you can nearly sometimes see cliques creating where starters would nearly kind of form groups of their own, and that's a terrible, terrible environment to be involved in. But like, if a team is going to be successful, like, you've got to prepare well, play well, and get a bit of luck. So if you're not preparing well, which is something you do most, because of kind of, I suppose, let's say a bad relation or a bad vibe from management to players, let's say, that's detrimental to a team. And I think, I said from my own experience, let's say, you could always get a vibe, you know, you'd get it weeks out. Like, you'd know there'd be A versus B challenge games inside in training, like 4 or 5 weeks out from championship games. So you'd know how the manager or management team, should I say, were thinking. You'd know even by the level of interaction, you know. So if the manager is kind of, I'll say, stonewalled you a bit somewhat, I say that loosely now, stonewalled you a bit somewhat, you can nearly guess that you're not going to be involved terribly. But the real settler is the A versus B game. So like, those games go right up to a week before championship. And generally the last week, the A team is put out entirely to get a sense of, I suppose, a bit of a game together, get a bit of feeling together, let's say, in pattern of playing and whatnot. So it's a funny one for managers. Like, I think it's very difficult to actually physically manage, because every player that goes into a county team is obviously the best player in their club. There's no doubt about that. So they'll have been used to being the number one guy or girl in their club for many years, let's say, underage level up into senior. And every time they go back to their club, they're champions, they're the main person. When they come into a county environment, then they don't know where they are in the pecking order. So that's a bit hard to take from a mental perspective for the player, to kind of transition from being top dog in the club to kind of one of the pack in the county team, let's say. And other players take that differently. I've seen guys who have walked out, you know, in years previous, let's say, when they haven't been on a starting 15 or 26 because they thought themselves to be higher in the rung, you know. So it's a tentative one for managers. But I think most managers nowadays, they're not nearly, from what I see, the top tier managers, they're more man managers, let's say. I know Bill Gates said before, let's say, the secret to good business is delegation. And that's what managers seem to have done, let's say. When you look at the Jim Gavins and the John Kiley's, they have a team around them, let's say, to manage everything, where they then manage the group as such. So I think that's kind of transitioned out of the whole setup now at the minute, and players and management alike are becoming more interaction from a personal perspective as opposed to a sporting perspective.
If you get stuck into some of the games then that will get the championship underway this weekend, James, mm-hmm. If you start with Leinster, Dublin against Antrim, 3 o'clock on Saturday, Laois against Wexford at 6 o'clock on Saturday. We touch on Wexford there, you talk about the power of delegation. Do you think Davy Fitz has the art of delegation off to a tee yet?
I did say top level managers, didn't I? So no, I wouldn't put, I don't think that delegation has really been, how do I say, it's tricky on that one to say. I've had Davy Fitz in college, don't get me wrong, to say, and delegation wouldn't be one of the words that he'd have, you know, I'll put that with you. Wexford are a tricky one, guys. I look at Wexford and like, they're a team, let's say, that kind of, you know, their class is a top class team. I wouldn't have them in the top 4 or 5. I would always view them as being a team that they nearly have enough, but they don't have enough, you know. Their forward unit, say, they don't score enough, let's say, the guys there. I don't think they have the quality up front. They have fantastic athleticism, there's no question about that. They have fantastic fitness, but every team across the board has that. So you go to any team, let's say, at top level, they're all going to be as fit as each other, and predominantly they'll be as strong as each other. But what really breaks it down then, say, is obviously tactical, and then the actual skill of the hurlers you have and the actual hurling ability. And I look at Wexford, and I just don't see they have enough. Like, in the last 4 championship games that Wexford has played Galway, you know, they've been beaten by an average of 8 points and have only scored 17 points at the tops of that. So I just wonder where the scores are going to come from, you know. And like, in those 4 same games, like, Galway has scored I think 27, 29 points in two others. So their defence offers a bit of leakage too as well. And I just don't see their defence holding out top-level forward lines, and I don't see the forwards, you know, taking down top-level back lines. So I Wexford and Leash, I think they'll come through Leash, obviously. You know, not trying to diminish Leash's capabilities, but I think when they come up against Kilkenny in the semi-final, that could be dangerous for them.
Was the forwards, the firepower in the forwards not an issue in 2019, or how did they manage to get so close then?
That's a strange. I just think, you know, I think momentum is a big thing in hurling too, guys. Like that game in 2019 with Galway, they drew 16 points apiece, I believe. And I just think Galway were suffering from a hangover from the 2 years previous, both mental and physical, you know. So they got a bit of a run. They got through the group by score difference, essentially, with a last spin a point against Kilkenny. And they just got a good draw, do you know what I mean? And they should have beaten Tipperary, let's say, when they were a man up, but they didn't. You know what I mean? That's the size of, like, Tipperary had a man down, let's say, when John McGrath got the line. And, you know, they didn't finish off Tipperary when they had them there. Do you know what I mean? When they had them there. And, like, the good teams, if you put in that year, let's say, if you put in most teams, I should say, against Tipperary with a man down, they're going to come through, you know? I just don't think they have it. I'm not trying to be dismissive or negative towards them in any way, shape or form. I've played them enough times to see that their passion, their game style is kind of repetitive, if I'm honest. I know David Fitz said last year after the semi-final, the Leinster semi-final, that they tried, five different formations. I saw one formation, maybe two. So I don't know where they're getting these formations out of. They didn't work. You know, they were beaten by 9 points or nine points, yeah. So I'm not sure where all the tactical knowledge, like where let's say, do they think they're more tactically ahead of people than they actually are, you know? So I know I'm being very negative towards Wexford, being dismissive, but look.
No, I mean, so that's the whole point. We've got to try and establish where the tiers are at this stage. If you were in charge of Wexford, like with this group of players, or is there anybody out there who could do things differently with this group of players and catapult them into that top tier?
Yeah, well, you're looking at the best coaches, aren't you? Like, you're looking at what Paul Kinnock has done with Clare. You're looking at what he's now done with Limerick. You know, he's transformed a team, let's say, who have been there, they're almost there, but not quite there, let's say, and brought an Ireland to them both, you know? Like, so he's the kind of person who come in with a serious air of positivity and no off-the-field baggage. You know, that's a key thing as well. Because I mentioned a few minutes ago about prepare well, play well, get a bit of luck. The preparation for Wexford has been staggered, in my opinion, let's say. There've been too many highlights or lowlights, should I say, in the public eye with regard to off-the-field activities and on the field or on the sideline, should I say, activities. And they don't need that distraction, do you know what I mean? And like I've been in the dressing rooms with David Fitz, like, and it's an intense place. You know what I mean? It's quite a, how would I put this lightly? It's quite a hyper dressing room. I put it that way, yeah. So the concentration levels could be focused elsewhere. If you get me, I'd be looking at it like a Paul Kinnock type person who'd be really good, really genuine. Like, they brought in Niall Corcoran, who was a good hurling man as well, a Galway guy. He was spent a lot of time in Dublin. He'd have a good hurling knowledge, but I don't know how much of an influence he's allowed to have there, should I say? But I do think as well, this possibly could be, in my opinion, the last year for Davy. I think there's going to be a change coming this year, because like they've had relatively minor success. They got a Leinster Championship, which is great, but I think that county now is looking for more, especially when you see budgetary figures, what's being implied into the team.
Okay, that's all really interesting, because I guess last year, if what happened last year happens again this year, then that makes obvious sense. If they get back to the level they were at, where they're in an All-Ireland semi-final and the game is in the melting pot, again, it'd be interesting to see how, if the group has learned how to manage their way through that. So if they're short of being contenders, is anybody close to the Limerick team at the moment? Are Tip and Galway the obvious ones who are there?
Yeah, you're right. Tip and Galway, My rankings for all they count for. Limerick are a clear number one. They have a degree of separation from the rest of the pack at the moment, and I think it's been well publicised about all they do well, and they do very little not well. Then I think I have Galway number two, and then I have a split between Tipperary and Kilkenny as giant number three. I can't separate either or. The game, whatever way a game goes on a certain day, could separate those by a point or two. And then after that, then you've got, again, not to be dismissive, you've got the rest. You've got Clare, Cork, Waterford in a pack, and then Wexford, as that'll say, with Dublin coming after. You know, it's a difficult one. I just think that you're looking at where Limerick stand right now. I'm not going to quite say they're where Kilkenny were in the mid-2000s or late 10s, but they're not too far away from it, to be honest with you. They haven't got quite the dominance that Kilkenny have had. But although if you look at the names in the cups over the last couple of years, Limerick have been, I suppose, shoving everyone out of the way. But I think it's going to be a different type of championship this year. I think Limerick, what they've done is this has been the same thing over the last couple of years, albeit very effective. But I just see maybe there's going to be a greater challenge to Limerick. Like, they won't be winning an Ireland final this year by 11 points like they did last year. It'll go down to the wire big time. And I think that you've got the likes of Galway and Tipperary who are going to challenge the most.
You just got a text in here, James, comparing the eras of Davy Fitz to Jose Mourinho, where almost after a couple of years, things start to, I don't know, grind down or maybe the level of early success isn't replicated. Is that a legit comparison, do you think? Is there something that you've seen that after a little period of time that things maybe aren't as good or as fresh as they were in those opening couple of seasons?
Yeah, like I modernisation, I think, you know, my time with Davy was back in 2007. We won the Fitzgibbon Cup with LIT. So you're talking 14, 15 seasons ago. And he's doing this, it looks to be, let's say, on the field, right, and technically speaking, he's doing the same things now as what was done back in the college times. And I do agree that whoever checks in there is onto something as well, because Mourinho, he came out of the blue, let's say, didn't have the best playing career, should I say, but then just blew up with Porto, and then he got such a massive run of success. And if you just disregard the Waterford final, let's say, for Davy in 2008, where they're hammered by Kilkenny, and go after that, let's say, it culminated in him being successful with Clare and then kind of having a great influence at Wexford. And, you know, sometimes a change is good as a break. So, like, when he went down to Wexford, that change kind of rejuvenated everyone at Wexford and created an air of kind of positivity. And that culminated in for me, the peak being the Leinster Championship, you know, 2 years ago. And I don't think they have reached similar heights. Obviously, they haven't reached similar heights from regards to everywhere. But off the field and on the field, I don't think they're where they need to be to challenge the top three or four. And I think that, as I said to you, I'm going back, I think this could be the last year Davy is in Wexford, and I'm calling it now. I think he will be in Dublin next year.
Right. Well, that'll be pretty interesting. Because the Dubs obviously just beat Galway last night in the under-20s, and that was a Galway team absolutely festooned with All-Ireland winners.
Stacked is what that Galway team was stacked. It was very disappointing, very, very disappointing. You know, I'm not just saying because we lost Dublin. It was a Leinster finalist, but it was, you know, I thought it was a good route, if I'm honest, to get to an Ireland final, especially after taking down Kilkenny last year. It was surprising, you know. I thought we were very wasteful. You know what I mean? Like from an individual basis, I know individuals come for sweet if all, let's say, on a team basis, but individual basis, we have outstanding hurlers in that team, especially in our forward unit, and we just didn't score enough. Like, we were quite wasteful in front of goals. We had three clear-cut goal opportunities that were, you know, denied by a good save or just wrong decisions, you know. And, like, I think Dublin needed that game too. They had a kind of a stuttering league campaign, if you like. They're going into a game against Navan now, whereby they need a bit of positivity. Like, Matty hasn't had the best league or championship game in the last 18 months. So with those 20 guys coming back in now, and they're saying well done instead of hard luck. So it's good for the vibe in the team as well, and just adds more positivity to the whole thing. Whereas with Galway, the good thing is I don't think there's too many guys on the senior panel. I know Derek and Goals and TJ at full back, let's say, but I think the Galway team is seasoned enough, let's say, to just override that result and move on to the senior championship.
Can I go back to one thing there? You were saying if Paul Kinnark was to leave for whatever reason, and, you know, again, this is idle speculation, but if he was to take over a team like Wexford, are the raw materials there in Wexford or indeed any of the other counties at the moment, with the right coaching, to put the challenge up to Limerick, bearing in mind you've compared Limerick to the great Kilkenny team, which is considered to be the greatest team of the modern era. Like, so, you know, I know they're not there yet, is what you said, and that it will be closer this year. Is coaching capable of making that much of a difference that almost any of those top teams in the right hands could put it up to Limerick on an All-Ireland final or semi-final day?
Yeah, I just think he's, like, now, don't get me wrong, I've never met Paul Kinnock. I've never been part of his training session. I've just spoken to guys who have been within the setup and who speak rave reviews about him, let's say, and they would give me snippets of things he does, he says, drills, he operates, and the way he operates on a personal level with people. And now, when I'm saying Paul Kinnock, I'm including the whole management team as well in that. But if you go back a couple of years ago, would you have thought, now, I mean this respectfully, would you have thought the Morrissey's or Gareth Hegarty would have reached the heights they have? Even Graham Mulcahy, who I'd be friendly with, and he'd be my age, Graham Mulcahy didn't set the world alight in his first, let's say, 7-8 years of inter-county hurling. And then he exploded under Paul Kinnock and got an All-Star, you know, when they won their Ireland. So So I do think coaching has a huge part to play. And like I've watched Limerick, some of the Limerick guys in club games, let's say on television last year, and lucky enough to see them, and they didn't stand out. You know, some of them didn't. They didn't stand out. They didn't stand out in a way that you'd see TJ with Ballyhale or you'd see Cathal Mannion with the Hatspur. They just didn't stand out that way. And I just think it's all part of, you know, the group, the setting, the way they set up tactically. And I think so. If you had Paul Kinnock and you brought him down to Wexford, I think there's great tangibles there. Like I said, they've got great quality player, like an individual. But that's why I said at the start of the conversation, their backs unit and their forwards unit aren't firing each for each other. Now I just think that if someone went in with a new voice and they changed things up a small bit and gave a different perspective, maybe more modern perspective, that Wexford could turn it around. Like they have the tangibles there, they have the finance, you know, they have the facility. So like if in a mad world that he did go down, he would make a huge difference to Wexford. And again, like from a bookies perspective, Wexford would go from number 7-8 up to, you know, 4-3 straight away. That's the influence I believe the Canuck would have.
Right.
A Canuck type person.
That's really interesting. There's one last thing I wanted to get your thoughts on. We're always interested in trends and trends in the game. Some suggestion in various places recently that maybe giving 5 points for a goal might change the way that the game is being played at the moment, because we're seeing such high scores in terms of the points being scored. I'm not even asking about that really, but is the trend, is there anything that might change the trend back to teams being goal hungry?
Yeah. Like I do think if you incentivize teams to go for, like, even if you raise it to 4 or 5 points, yeah, you're putting more pressure on the goalie first of all. But I think we do have to do something, guys, because like I just did a bit of research there over the last week on the whole points situation. Like in the last 5 at Ireland finals, there's been an average of 25 points scored, whereas the 5 previous there was 18. So that's a huge difference in a final. You know, 7 points is a huge. It's a huge distance, like, and the points situation is just getting a bit out of control because teams are looking at it and they're saying to themselves, we don't have to do it. You know, we don't have to go for goals because we can just shoot the lights out. Because when you mix the hurdles, the slithers, the condition of the players, you know, and the quality of where they can shoot from shooting zones, that all leads itself towards scoring 30, 35. And we could potentially see 40 points in the championship game this year, which is, I don't know, has that ever been done? There does need to be a degree of incentivization. I wouldn't like to see, I know I spoke about it before, a heavier ball. I like to see the ball modern. I've just kind of modified a small bit. I would like to see, I'd love to see forwards, and I mean this in a good way, the full forward line, I'd love to see them be capped and not being allowed across the line. You know what I mean? I'd love to see them, let's say, if you picked an imaginary 30-yard line and say, right, full forward line, you're not allowed past that line inside. I think that would help the situation. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It would definitely help, let's say, the get around ultra-defensive teams, if you like. But I agree with you guys. Incentivization is key. How we go about it, I'm not too sure. I know we trialled the sideline cut before with 2 points. I think guys got around that and they started shooting sidelines from all sides. So that had to come back, you know, with Joe Kenning and Noel McGrath and whatnot. So if you did go for 5 points for a goal, let's say, I think there would be a lot more direct hurling. I think it would cut out an awful lot of, you know, middle third passing, as you call it, in you know, intersection play between guys who were only 10, 15 yards apart from each other. And again, it was so evident in last night's game. There was guys just shooting passes for 10, 15 yards, sometimes for the sake of it. I think it's just now ingrained into the pattern of play for most teams at the moment because it's popular. You know, it's what Limerick are doing and that's the magic potion out to a successful team, you know. So five points for goal is a good shout. Good shout. I would like it as a goalie, though.
Cork won 140 against Westmeath in 2019, I think, is the record, James. So you can see that being... Yeah. You can see that being surpassed at some point.
Yeah, like okay. Again, with respect, the gulf in class between Cork and Westmeath, let's say, would have been substantial at the time. Let's say, so 40 points would, yes, albeit it would be a surprise, but with that specific game, not so much. I think if you're looking at, you know, a Limerick versus a Cork now, I'm not going to say it would happen. Let's say, if 40 points was hit, my God, that's an element of madness entirely.
Yeah,
you know, that's when you have quality opposition who are very close-ish. That kind of score is just eruptions.
Let's see if it happens against a Division One team, and at that point there'll definitely be a symposium on what's gone wrong. James, this has been brilliant. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Cheers.
No bother, folks. Thanks.
James Scale helping us to preview the start of the Hurling Championship this weekend properly. Dublin against Antrim at 3 o'clock on Saturday. Wexford against Laois at 6 on Saturday. And then we didn't even talk about Clare and Waterford in any detail, but that one throws in at 3:30 on Sunday. You'll get plenty of preview and reaction and analysis to that on Saturday and Sunday on Off the Ball on News Talk. John Duggan is with us this morning. Well, of course, he'll be in the presenter's chair on Saturday. John, how are you? What's going on?
Good, Jaron Owen. Yeah, it's all about the last 16 of the Euros now. Die Mannschaft going to Wembley next Tuesday for the England-Germany game. 66 and all that, 96 and all that. Gareth Southgate missed penalties. Andy Muller strutting his stuff. All those things. So 2-2 draw against Hungary last night for the Germans. Leon Goretzka making that heart shape to the Hungarian fans. And then Ronaldo getting to 109 international goals with two penalties against the French. I loved Paul Pogba's silver service delivery at times. It was absolutely fantastic. So what do we got? Well, Saturday, 5 o'clock, Wales, Denmark and Amsterdam. Saturday at 8, Italy, Austria at Wembley. Sunday at 5, the Dutch against the Czechs in Budapest. Sunday at 8, Belgium, Portugal. That'll be a brilliant game in Seville. Monday at 5, Croatia, Spain in Copenhagen. Monday at 8, France against Switzerland in Bucharest. Tuesday at 5, England, Germany at Wembley. And Tuesday at 8, Sweden against Ukraine at Hampden. If England get past Germany, they've got quite a nice passage to the final.
I think everybody else on that side of the group thinks the same, don't they? Or that side of the draw. Like, everybody's like, ooh.
Yeah. The Dutch would. Denmark would. And Denmark have momentum now. Even Sweden, Ukraine. But the other side of the draw, Croatia, Spain against the winners of the France game. And Italy, potentially, against Belgium or Portugal. Brilliant stuff.
Portugal didn't really get much of a reward for being the best team. Belgium didn't get much of a reward for being the best team in the tournament so far, did they?
No, they didn't. And that's sometimes just the way it goes in international tournaments. Go back to the Dutch and the Germans in 1990. Sometimes the World Cup final or the Euros final is actually earlier in the tournament than the final itself.
It definitely feels that way, and that might be the case this year. Although, who knows? Like, I mean, if you're English, you must be feeling pretty good about life, right?
Well, it's not about anybody else. It's about how England set up themselves. England will defeat themselves, not the Germans, not any other team. This is about Southgate getting it right. Can he get it right? He's got a few days now to make the right calls.
They're going to the final, John, aren't they?
If they beat Germany, I think they are, yeah. I don't rate the Dutch. The Denmark, I do think, are...
Team of destiny.
Decent. Yeah, team. They're a decent side. But I do feel if England can overcome Germany, they could be in the final.
Yeah, there's enough madness about that Dutch team to knock England out. My issue, John, though, is that I'm not sure the Dutch will actually get there. I think that there's enough madness about them for them to get beaten in the last 16 or in the quarterfinal for them to actually be a semi-finalist for England.
Well, remember Poland and Portugal went to penalties last time round, didn't they? And Portugal ended up winning the tournament. There will be shocks in this last 16. Yeah. There will be penalty shootouts. There, like, even Ukraine, who I put as my dark horse, I was a bit disappointed with them in the group stage. You know,
they were rubbish, I thought.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, they weren't
great. Well, for about 20 minutes against the Dutch, they were all right. But apart from that, they weren't great. Yeah. But they could beat Sweden. So yeah, like, it's fascinating. Absolutely right. Fascinating.
Anything else before we get into virtual insanity?
Well, just that Cluxton seems to be training again, if you believe the back pages. We'll see. I mean, I'm shrugging my shoulders. If he turns up in goal against, was it Wicklow or Wexford, then I'll believe it. There's nothing really that concerns me. Leona Maguire is interesting because she's involved in the USPGA this week, the third major of the year, after such a great performance last week.
And also in the Olympics team, like one of our, the men's team for the golf, definitely a good medal chance. But you're like, well, hang on a second now. She's definitely, her and Stephanie Meadow, it's a good chance of something coming from the women in the golf as well. So, okay, well, look, speaking of golf, time for this week's Virtual Insanity. How are we getting on?
We're doing well. We've had a good few weeks. John Rahm, unfortunately, I should have done a Matt Damon and rounders and gone all in. I didn't. So he was my second pick because I was a bit spooked by that whole Memorial Tournament COVID thing. Unfortunately, I should have gone all in, but we still made a profit of 62% last week because we Cabrera Bayo placed in the first round leader market at 30-1. So it wasn't a bad week. So we're back to pretty much parity.
Right, great.
Ahead of the Travelers Championship, which starts today. So the eye is pretty much in now, lads. So I do feel my eye is in. So what are we going to go with? Okay, Abraham Answer. 28-1 for three each way. 23rd in the world, yet to win on the PGA Tour. One of the shortest hitters on tour. Missed the cut last week, but I think this is a completely different course. 11th in greens hit this year. Tied for 11th and 8th in this tournament before. He's knocking on the door. 5 top 10s, including the second behind Rory at the Wells Fargo. Abraham Answer from Mexico is the headline tip to break his duck this week at the Travelers Championship at River Highlands, a very short course in Connecticut. Patrick Cantlay, 2 each way, 16-1, shot a 60 at this course as a 19-year-old amateur. We know he's playing very well, tops the FedEx Cup standings, won the Memorial 15th of the US Open last week, three top 15s in a row in this tournament. You can't leave Patrick Cantlay out. Ricky Fowler, 50-1 for 2 each way, 11th on Memorial, 8th at the US PGA, failed to qualify for the US Open, so he's fresh, 13th on two appearances at this course. And a very good quality golfer, still a very talented player, has had a slump, but I think he's coming back. Ricky Fowler, 50s. Doc Redman, one of my favourites, is 66 for 2 each way. Second, we had him in the stake for the Palmetto Championship. He was just a shot out of winning it, tied for second. Was 11th in this on his first appearance last year with a 63 at closing round. Plays the easier golf course as well, does Doc. 66-1, I think, is value. Will Gordon at 150-1. For 2 each way, shot 27 birdies in this tournament last year to finish on a tie for third, was tied for 14th on his last start. A massive hitter, and people like Bubba Watson have won this tournament before. Will Gordon at 150 for 2 each way, and Patrick Rogers for Euro 50 each way at 150-1. Adam in the first round leader market last week, he was very close to getting that. Had three good rounds out of four, has been tied for third of this tournament before, and he could be one of these players. He had as impressive a college career as Tiger Woods, just has not translated to the main tour. So Patrick Rogers, Will Gordon, Doc Redman, the kind of outsiders, Ricky Fowler, Patrick Cantlay, and Abraham Answer. I'm feeling confident.
All right, that's this week's Virtual Insanity with John Duggan. It's up now on the OTB Sports app. And of course, as I said, you can hear more from John all afternoon on Saturday afternoon here on OTB. And you can get it on the OTB Sports app. Of course, that is going to be Saturday afternoon, the first game in the Lions series. They play Japan. Don't know if it's going to be a test yet. Probably will be. I think at the end of the year they're going to decide it is. And then the eight matches that they're going to play in South Africa, every single second of every game live on Off the Ball. You can get it on Off the Ball on News Talk. Brian O'Driscoll and Alan Quinlan are going to be alongside Neil Tracy on commentary for the three test matches. Devin Toner, Neve Briggs and Jack Carty among the co-coms for the warm-up games. Andy Dunn in the commentary box alongside Neil for the 3 o'clock kickoff live this Saturday afternoon on News Talk. Our coverage will be brought to you in association with Vodafone, lead partner of the British and Irish Lions. So that's crack with that.
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty exciting little while. This Saturday is quite the day of sport. It is one of those mega sporting Saturdays. Obviously, those last 16 games. The last 16 fair on Saturday, probably the weakest, but still, you've got what is a semi-test, let's call it, in the Lions. And obviously, you've got Mayo and Kerry in action. You've got hurling. It's from 3 o'clock to 10 o'clock, basically, wall to wall on a variety of different levels, which kind of makes these summer Saturdays, I think.
Exactly. It's 8:54 this morning. If you want to get in touch, you can WhatsApp us. 0879-180-180 is the WhatsApp number. Leave a comment in the YouTube stream. We'll get to that. I'll use the hashtag OTBAM. Sue Murphy, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning. How are you?
Well, we're all talking about murder in West Cork, right? It's it's Sophie Tuscan season on everything.
Yeah, like everywhere. This is out on Sunday on Netflix. I've seen both of them now. I actually had the Jim Sheridan one for last week, but it was really heavily embargoed, so I couldn't really talk about it. But there is all of the drama around that the family have asked for the interviews to be taken out. They thought the documentary was quite sympathetic to Ian Bailey. I think everyone knows the story of Sophie Tuscan-Tapontier, but I don't know if they know all of the details. You know, she was murdered in West Cork in 96. Her body was found at the bottom of the laneway outside of her house, and there's never anyone been convicted of her murder. It's I have to say, I think the Jim Sheridan doc is the better doc. He actually features in it, and I was really surprised when he popped up on screen, because it's not like him to do something like that. I was like, oh, and he's kind of telling the story, and I think that's actually quite good, because he's very attached to that story, and he's been embedded in it for about 20 years. And he's he basically is so attached with that he wants the justice for Sophie. And I think he actually did a good job. Like, that's what's really upsetting about them taking out the family interviews, because I thought he got their grief across very well and why they want justice for her and what had happened. And it's the whole thing is such a tragic case. But the Netflix one, in comparison, there's three episodes in that. There's five in the Jim Sheridan one. it's a much zippier, like it's very, very fast. It moves through things very, very quickly. Like the first episode, I'd say, is probably the like 1 to 3 of Sheridan's. Sheridan really lays the groundwork of, you know, the area, what her life was like, what her family was like. They kind of get through that a little bit quicker in the Netflix one. It seems a bit more dramatic than Sheridan's is. I think he's a little bit more sensitive, actually, than the Netflix one is. I did feel after I'd seen almost 5 episodes of both, I was a bit like, this is like, I felt uncomfortable. I felt uncomfortable knowing the amount of information that I knew about that woman. And I am one of those people who loves true crime, but I think it was probably because I was watching it back to back. I just think in terms of like, if you were looking at them as documentaries, you'd say Sheridan's documentary is better. But
the true crime thing is really interesting, right? Like, it's grand when it's over in America and it has nothing to do with us and it's like, harlar. When it's down the road, a few fields over, essentially, and these people are living and walking amongst us, and there's really compelling content that sucks you in, and yet it's clearly, in a way, sucking us in that's for our enjoyment and entertainment. Because that's what it is. That's what, like, we sit down on our couch to be shocked, to be horrified, but ultimately it's entertainment and it's to do numbers and it's for clicks and it's for eyeballs and it's yet the murder of a woman. And look, I mean, I think the thing about the podcast was that it was slow, and again, I don't know, like, I don't know how I can have this duplicity in my own mind where I think the podcast is okay, but I'm very, like, squeamish about sitting down and watching these, and yet I probably will. Like,
yeah, and that's what's uncomfortable about it, is it, like, the down the road thing. Like, it's West Cork. Like, the intros into both of these are news reports of voices that you know from the radio, or Marion Finucan talking about it on Crimeline, and that just gives an extra edge to it, I think, when you're watching as an Irish audience, because this is a really remote part of Cork with a kind of an international kind of population. There's a lot of people down there from different parts of the world that are artists, producers, filmmakers, all that kind of stuff, and then a small local population. So there's something really eerie about it. And like for her to be in that house by herself at Christmas, nobody heard anything, nobody knew what happened. It's just, I was actually quite upset by it. Any of those documentaries, you know, like, I watched Case File, a list to Case File back to back, I've listed 140 episodes. I've never felt that I think I know too much here. And I really felt that with this.
What do you think, Owen? You are from down the road.
I do think that the grim outcome of this is that this will create a sort of cult around West Cork a little bit, almost not just as a tourist destination, but as a place of intrigue internationally, which is kind of grim to think about, that it kind of plays into what you're saying there, that there is a sort of fascination that triggers the same part of our brain that is kind of used for positive things. And for us to have this thing happening down the road where there will be an international fascination, it is something that kind of sits a little bit uneasily.
We don't care when it's in Mexico or Canada, or England.
Contradiction, yeah. Absolutely. And that's just the way it is. Well, sorry to slightly change the subject here, but what is with documentaries of a similar subject always coming out at once, Sue? Is there like some sort of embargo on certain content? Because obviously we had the fire situation a couple of years ago where you had an Amazon and Netflix. Why does this happen? Like, what's the content decision there?
I have my suspicions about what happened. I'm afraid to say nothing in case I get sued, but I think there might have been something in the works there at Netflix before, and then Sheridan was working on this separately, and they just, I think they both knew when they were coming out, and they were like, okay, we need to get these out of the round at the same time.
Well, it happens in the film industry all the time, where one studio announces that they're doing one type of blockbuster and the other studios will knock together anyhow shite spoiler to make sure that they, if it's a massive success, you cash in on it and you also get the opportunity to like steal its thunder a little bit if yours gets out first. So,
but it's like, I mean, that
it's kind of like, not to compare, but like Finding Nemo on Shark Tale. You know,
that's I had never really computed that, but like, I guess that kind of also plays into the grim nature of it as well. Just the how. You're right, Sue. Like, I mean, this is just a purely, or Jerry, the purely commercial thing to get clicks, to get views, to get eyeballs on it.
Think of it like this, though. In 2002, News Talk put out a daily sports show called Off the Ball, and then within about 2.5 or 3 or 4 years, RTE suddenly decided that there was going to be a nightly sports radio show. This is what happens in the game.
It is what happens. It's the game going to say it again. It's like, I mean, but this doesn't seem to be like a response. It seems like simultaneous, like, and I'm sure that there's insider information, so they know that something's coming months and months and months in advance, and they can get ahead of it.
Well, it's camera crews down in a certain area. Somebody rings somebody, and it's like, oh, was that your guys? No, what? No, that wasn't us. That was, who was it? What? And then there's a rush from the executives to, because the thing is, the audience for one is probably the same audience for the other, right?
Like, yeah,
a lot of people are actually going to watch both.
They will, and the people, I think, will have come to. What's going to happen here is that the Netflix thing is going to be the biggest one of all of the works on this subject, and then people will go to the Sky one, and people will go to the podcast, and people will just gorge on information. Whenever we watch something, like whenever you watch a movie, the first thing you do is, well, the first thing I do is maybe go on to IMDb, look at the cast members I'm not familiar with, look at the backstory that's based on a true story. People, once they get a taste of something, even if it's a multi-part series, just want more of that thing. So you're right, they will absolutely be gorging on this a little bit, but maybe it's the sort of thing, Sue, that you get your fill after a while, especially if you binge just one of them.
Yeah, like, the other thing that I have a problem with this is the family are so desperate. They're desperate to find out information. You know, that's what's really upsetting about it, is it, like, you can tell they're just going to do anything to try and get information about what happened to her. And if this is the next avenue, then they have to take it. And that's, I actually find that really hard to watch. Her father, he can't get through the sentence of talking about her without breaking down crying. So it's quite difficult. I found it quite the whole thing quite difficult to watch, actually.
And the other thing is the cops, the role of the cops and all this. I hope that is, I haven't seen this yet, but I hope that like is half of the entire thing.
Yeah, it's a good bit, and they really focus in on it. Like, there was not a good job done around this, you know?
No, a fairly horrific blundering at various different stages. And that's why no one's ever going to feel comfortable about whatever comes out of this. Right, so let's move on. The films this week.
Yeah, so Fast and Furious 9 is out this week, just to mention it. I actually haven't seen it yet, but I plan on going to see it. But I absolutely love Fast and Furious, because they're the films that you go into cinema, you have popcorn, you have a drink, and you just turn your brain off for 2 hours. And I think everyone who's involved in it knows how crap they are, and everyone who's going to see it knows how crap they are, and everyone's fine about that. And I like that about it. It doesn't take itself too seriously. But I love the whole plotline around this one. Is like, Vin Diesel has an evil twin brother who just shows up. You're like, oh my gosh, are we going back to Dallas for plot lines? It's just like, it's hilarious. But anyway, on the other side, we went to see The Father last week and went to an actual cinema, which was a lovely experience. We were walking in the door, and I said to my husband, this is going to be really sad. And he went, I don't know anything about it. And I was like, well, it's a film about dementia, it's going to be really sad. And he was like, oh, are we not going to A Quiet Place? And I was like, no, that's a very different film. So The Father is about Anthony Hopkins, who's suffering late in life with dementia. And it's told from his point of view. So it's brilliant, because it's him trying to piece together a day or a couple of hours or what's happening. And there's all these, like, it moves to different types of the times of the day, different things that he's drinking, different things that he's wearing, different people he's talking to, doesn't understand who his daughter is. It's actually, like, you know, with Anthony Hopkins winning the Oscar, everyone was like, should Chadwick Boseman have won that? No, like, he is absolutely amazing. This is the best role he's ever played. Is it something you, like, there's two very different films there if you want to go see them in cinema. Like, Fast and Furious is probably your all entertainment action film. But The Father, if you're looking for something that's a very good, it's borderline a play in a film, Anthony Hopkins is spectacular in this, and you'll come out and be like, I really don't want to get old. It's very depressing. Really hits on the head.
Don't worry, the entire planet is on fire, and we're not going to get old. We're going to be one of those generations that doesn't make it to the. We're going to see the ends of the earth, Sue. Don't worry. That's the cheery thing you should take away. So make sure you spend the weekend binge watching something
apocalyptic or that.
If you miss it, this week is The Staircase.
Yeah, I just thought with the true crime stuff, keeping it in that kind of vein, The Staircase was one that I've never in my life watched so much information about blood spatter. But that's what this is all about. So it's a man called Michael Peterson, whose wife was found at the bottom of the stairs dead, and he was suspected of her murder. But he said that she fell down the stairs and he had nothing to do with it. And all of the episodes of this go through. It's sort of like The Jinx. You're never quite sure where you stand with it or what his involvement is. And he's a strange individual at the best of times. So you're second guessing every time you feel. And he's a very like strong family unit who are very supportive of him. So, and you're kind of like, did he do it all the way through it? And to be honest, what's interesting about this, I mean, obviously it's terrible. There's a woman dead. Same thing we're talking about with Sophie. But it's him. He loves having the camera around. He loves talking about poetry. And then there's this other thing where he's like, I have nothing to do with the death of my wife. It's actually fascinating. Like, and it's a real binge watch. If you sit down, you're not going to be able to turn it off. You'll go through every single episode.
Yeah. So we did that and watched it probably around the time. So 2018, I think. I can't remember what happens. I'm on the Wikipedia page. You're going, oh yeah. But it's funny how the 13 episodes that we were completely consumed by is just
13,
like
it's just so long.
No room in my brain for what happened. I couldn't tell you if he's out now or if he's in now. So anyway, don't spoil it for us. No. Grant, you haven't seen it, have you?
No, thank you for forgetting everything there. I look forward to watching all 13 episodes.
Very quickly, you want to mention Mare of Easttown? You finished it?
Yes, I don't know if Tommy put up my texts. I guessed the end and I ruined it for Tommy in the process. But I was absolutely delighted because I had spent ages thinking about it. Like I was borderline with an incident room in the house with all of the lines going to all the different people who were involved. But it got to the end and I was down on my knees in front of the telly with my arms up going, yes, I guessed the right person. So that's the way I watch TV. It's not about shame, it's about being right. But if you haven't seen it, it's really like Kate Winslet and it's really, really excellent. And like there was a part of me that at the start of the last episode I was like, I'll be fine if they just do this about what happens with her and her family. She's really, really interesting and her family were amazing. But I really enjoyed it. Okay. I'm just delighted I got it right.
And Halston?
I loved Halston. Like if you're into these, like it's a Ryan Murphy thing. So if you think Glee, just like turn your brain off, everything looks pretty. That's what it is. And it's really great because of that. And the last thing I have to mention, because Owen is such a big fan, is Love Island is back on Monday at 9:00.
Nice.
Do you want to talk about your problem with Love Island?
Just checking what are the Euros fixtures on Monday night. Does anybody have them handy? Is it that's the night before England, isn't it? Whatever it is.
Switzerland.
France-Switzerland.
Right. You can flick that over. 2-0 at halftime.
No, I'm not talking about switching up, but I think for the sake of humankind, France-Switzerland should be postponed. Should be moved back to the 2:00 game the next day or pushed forward to the 2:00 game that day. UEFA, who've had a shocker of a tournament, can finally do something right by moving a game out of the way of Love Island, because this is important. And it's finally we get our culture back, because we had a summer without Love Island last year. And I think that's the main reason why the pandemic was so tough on everyone.
I mean, we were joking about this, but like in the Off the Ball office, every single person watches this, talks about it. Like
no.
Joe Malloy went on and talked to
Ivan
Yates about it.
Not every
but
single
you're
person.
But you're the only one, Jerry.
Well, there you go. It's good to be home wearing the pink t-shirt sometimes. That's a cultural reference.
We even got Adrian
called Simpsons.
Andy Lee was in our Love Island group. Like that's the extent to what we're talking about here, you know.
Right, I have finished Friday Night Lights, and we should definitely talk about that because
it's one of my favourites.
It's really, really excellent. I was surprised at how good it was and how it stood up and all that kind of stuff too. So, anyway, Sue, good stuff. Thanks a million. What's out in the podcast this week?
Oh, we have it's Andrea Gilligan. She's going to be talking about Shawshank Redemption. So it's a film she used to watch with her dad. Her dad sadly passed away, but it was one of those ones that they used to go back to together all the time. So it's a really nice story. So we have that out and let's go back to this week.
Okay, so the podcast called Let's Get Back To. It's available on the Go Loud player, and we also stick it up on the
OTB Highlights. Yeah,
there you go. OTB AM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razor. Sue is with us every Thursday to tell you what to watch for the weekend. Here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio for the rest of the day. At 11 o'clock live, it's the Euro 2020 show. OTB Gold at 1, it's Cora Staunton. History Sport Extra Series with Paul Rouse at 3. Our retro panel football special with Hartson, Holland and Cunningham. Brian are just going to meet Ethan Asewa as OTB Gold tonight at 6. We're going to be back after these.
OTB AM.
12 minutes past 9 this morning. We're going back to Gaelic football, and the championship build-up is really underway at this point, and we're particularly looking forward to eventually seeing Kerry against Dublin. So no better man to talk to than Eamon Fitzmaurice. Airgrid have announced a 5-year partnership extension for the GAA official timing sponsorship. Airgrid, the state-owned company that manages and develops Ireland's electricity grid to deliver a cleaner energy future, is now in its 6th year as the official timing partner of the GAA. As part of the announcement, 3-time All-Ireland winning player and All-Ireland winning manager with Kerry, Eamon Fitzmaurice, spoke to us yesterday.
The intercounty thing is a huge commitment, and it's a huge commitment for everyone in your life. It's a commitment for you, obviously, but it's also a commitment for your wife, your family, you know, your extended family. Kind of everyone's nearly involved in it, really, because there's so much goes into it. So there's a lot to be considered when you're getting involved in it. But at the moment, I'm happy where I am. I'm happy looking on and enjoying supporting the Kerry lads.
And how are you broadening your horizons then on a coaching level, as you mentioned there? Is it just from a bit of training here and there and watching as many games as possible, or are you tapping into other resources as well?
Watching, and I'm starting to read a bit again, which I hadn't been doing, and the appetite is there to possibly start attending coaching conferences and things like that again, which wasn't. It just genuinely wasn't there for a while. I suppose I had spent so long at it that I needed a bit of a break from it, and even just to refresh my mind and refresh my thinking on the game and everything, I felt that it was good to take a bit of a step back and allow that hunger to return naturally, and it has, and I'm enjoying doing that, and I'm enjoying doing the bit of reading and stuff at the moment, and you know, just getting the brain ticking over in that way again.
Anything good that you'd recommend on the reading front?
Anything good? there's plenty of stuff. A book I had read at the time, and I'm rereading at the moment, is Pochettino's book he did with Guillaume Balaga when he was in Spurs. I remember at the time I read it, and it was a kind of a speed read, but there was some good insights in it, so I'm rereading that. I read Kevin Welch's book recently. Very good insight, a lot of good stuff in that, and very honest and open book, in fairness to Kevin. And I enjoyed that read. So they're kind of the two that I have on the go at the moment. But I'm sure I'll dip into other stuff when I'm off over the summer.
The Pochettino thing is fascinating, isn't it? The way, I guess, he took a club from a fairly decent level and all of a sudden got them to a whole other level when it came to their commitments, to the meters they were running on the training pitch. A lot of fellas were ruthlessly cut from that team. Like, that is straight off, I'd imagine, a Bible for any coach out there in terms of how you can make measured improvements as a coach.
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. And I just think done in a very exact but caring way as well. Mm. And that certainly comes across in the book. And once you were with him, he'd do anything for you, but he wasn't afraid to take the hard decisions either, and just all the different experiences he had himself, both as a player and as a manager, feeding into his coaching style. And it's a good read, and I'm enjoying it. And you know, like I said, I remember reading it at the time. I think it probably came out maybe September, October 2017, around that time. I remember.
Yeah, the season was in flow, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember reading it back around that time, and you know, like I said, at the time it was I kind of shot through it, but I'm reading it a bit more measured this time, and probably taking in more of it.
You're not a Spurs fan, are you?
I'm not. No, I'm a Man United fan.
Right. Well, what kind of GAA coach learned from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer then, do you think?
Well, I think, in fairness to him, and we're in a group of United fans and we'd be debating back and forth. But I think one thing is he's certainly very good at tapping into the tradition of what Man United should be about. And I think he's trying to bring back basically the Alex Ferguson values and things that might have been lost in the meantime since Alex Ferguson finished up and might have been a bit diluted with all the chopping and changing that has happened on the managerial front. But I think he's bringing stability and I think he's, in terms of his values and the way he looks at what Man United should be and should represent, I like that side of it from the coaching perspective. I'm still looking to see what exactly is going on, but we'll give more time and we'll see where that goes.
That's it. And the thing about Solskjaer is that at any of those great moments during the season they just had, the crowd, if they were there, would have been unbelievable, like, because everybody, every Manchester United fan, I'd imagine, just really wants him to do well. So hopefully, yeah, from a United perspective, that comes into play next season. Eamon, when it comes to the Gaelic football, then, like, this season has already been talked up as the saviour of modern Gaelic football. Is the hype real? Like, can we believe what we saw in the league with these big scorelines and lots of kick-passing and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, well, so far it is. Look, I think a big thing has been playing a league, you know, later with the pitch conditions, the air conditions, decent weather for a lot of the games. In terms of will it continue for the championship, I think, look, even for a lot of the games, some teams were still setting up quite defensively. They were getting bodies behind the ball, but players were just playing excellent football. They were taking the right options. They were kicking huge scores. They were kicking scores from out the field. They were getting through defences, even if there was plenty of bodies back there, with pace, with good movement, with 1-2s, with good football. So I think there's, you know, while there is still strong defensive structures in place by some teams, I think teams are getting better and better at picking holes in it. I think players are becoming more and more accurate, and they're probably getting the ball to the shooters and to the best shooters more often. So yeah, it augurs well, and the league has been outstanding, and there's been brilliant football across all of the divisions. So hopefully it'll continue now for the summer.
One of the things that seems to be popping up is that teams are now realising that the full court press is almost a necessity in a lot of games. Are you seeing this as a more aggressive press even from, say, 2016 in that semi-final where you guys really would have done it to Dublin that year?
Yeah, no, I think it's constantly evolving. And obviously when we tried that day, that was extreme and it was new and it worked. But unfortunately, we didn't get the opportunity to do it more in the second half. But teams have tweaked this, and, you know, for us starting off that day, it was a kind of a static enough zone in terms of that the players were getting to a zone and they were kind of staying within their zone. But more and more teams now are getting better at it being a moving zone and adjusting as the keeper is kicking and making it even harder for the goalkeeper. So there's constant tweaks going on with it, but, you know, all teams have figured out really that it is risk-reward, but the risk, you know, or the reward far outweighs the risk from the point of view that even if you lose the kick-out, you still have time to get bodies back once it isn't a boomer over the top and you can get caught open. And some teams are trying that. And in fairness to goalkeepers like Rory Began, Niall Morgan, you know, Sean Patton, fellas that have a big boost and that can kick it 70 and 80 yards, they're trying that, and you'll probably see a couple of goals from that over the summer. But I think overall teams are being rewarded for pressing like that, and we'll probably see more and more of it for the summer.
The moving zone is very interesting. Like, I know we might be at risk of like getting into too much of the nitty-gritty here, but does that change the type of player you would be looking for as a coach in your forward line then? Does it just favour more athletes again?
It doesn't. I think, look, all players are so athletic now, and they're so, you see very few, you know, players that aren't able to move. So if at all, they're all so athletic and they're so, you know, mobile and agile as well. So I think that teams, you know, particularly when they get the press on and when, like I said, when they're moving around and when they're being, that bit of flexibility is coming into it. It's exciting to watch, and I think, look, again, when we get the crowds back to games, it's certainly a thing that'll get people off their seats. And I think everyone likes it, unless you're the poor goalkeeper and you're after losing two or three in a row and you're trying to figure a way out of this. You know, it's something I mentioned in an Examiner column I wrote earlier on the year. I'm looking for the next step in it now rather than the team that are pressing. What's the next step in terms of beating the press? And I'd love to see something like an overload going the opposite direction, if you know what I mean. If the team taking the kick out are taking the risk, that they're loading it up the other way and that they're leaving players inside, you know, that if you've three or four in the full forward line, you're just letting them there because you know it's going long and you know it's going to a certain part of the field. And if you lose it, then you're trying to adjust. I think there's something in that. But I'm looking forward to seeing, like I said, who's going to be the one to bring the next step in terms of breaking a press. I think there's only so much more you can do in terms of setting the press and the kick out, but breaking it going the other way is the interesting thing for me at the moment.
Right. We'll keep an eye on that over the next little while. Like, I guess Kerry, to a point, have got caught on that on a number of occasions. It happened once against Roscommon. The most obvious example, obviously, Conor O'Callaghan against Dublin. Is that then where you would pick as a weak point in Kerry's title charge this year?
Yeah, again, look, that's the risk-reward thing. And if you're... Look, I think against Dublin, they're so good. If you give them all their own kickouts, and if you don't, at least push up and contest some of them, and possibly that's the way to approach it is a mix. But I think unless you're giving them some problems in their own kickout, you're not going to win the match. It's as simple as that. They're too good. And if you're giving them 50% of the ball straight off their own kickout, they're going to beat you, and they're going to beat you pulling up. So I think you have to go after it. But that's the beauty of the league, and that's the beauty of mistakes like that happening. You know, there'll be tweaks, and Peter Keane and the management team will be looking at that. If this happens again, this is the way we're going to deal with it. And that's the beauty of having matches and having the context of matches to improve and stuff. And that's one of the most enjoyable things of being involved with a team or managing or coaching a team, is seeing those things, trying to fix it. If it happens again, that you have fixed it. It's just making you stronger all the time.
It does seem, when it comes to Kerry, Eamon, that there is now a cohort of players like Dermot O'Connor and Darragh Moynihan who aren't just fit to make the 15, they're fit to make a real mark in big games this year. Is that the way you see it, and how important will that be later in the summer?
Yeah, big time. And look, I think the players from the successful minor teams now are starting to really put their stamp on the team. And you know, going up to the lads from the 2014 team, which would be the likes of Brian O'Beoglia, Tom Sullivan, those lads, back to the younger lads, then they now are there a couple of years. You know, Tom and Brian and them are there since 2016, so they have a lot of experience in terms of being involved in the squad and then getting into the team. The likes of Darragh Moynihan and Dermot O'Connor. Dermot started the All-Ireland replay in 2019, which was a huge experience for him. And he's continued to develop. And he's going to be a fantastic player for Kerry. And he had a brilliant league this year. And hopefully he'll continue on into the championship. Similarly with Darragh Moynihan, you know, he's a real type of player you'd want on your team in terms of he'd do the hard work. He can be abrasive, he'll win breaks, but he's also excellent on the ball and he'll get scores for you. So it's great to see those fellas now with experience under their belt, probably more comfortable now as well, starting and knowing that they can contribute. And like I said, hopefully that'll continue on into the championship, and that if and when Kerry get to Croke Park, that they'll be really ready for those battles at that stage.
And they've got as tough a Munster championship as you could possibly ask for. It should be Clare, Tip, then Cork. Like, people will say this is Yerraism or whatever, but I mean, that is as tough as you could possibly ask for throughout the Munster championship. And you would assume, and it is an assumption, that the ghosts of last year will ensure that there won't be any complacency in those three games.
Yeah, and look, I think in fairness to the lads last year, I don't think complacency would have been a factor. I think it was a poor performance on the day, and that can happen. I think the days of complacency are gone. going back to my own time when we were involved, whether it was Clare or Tipperary or Limerick or Waterford or whoever we were playing in the Munster Championship, it was the same. We prepared the same as if we were playing Dublin. It was, it was as simple as that. And of course, you can't get into a player's mind, and a player might expect to win a game or whatever. But if they're not performing, they're going to be hauled off. And we certainly, you know, would have prepared for every team the same way. And I think, look, in Kerry, the lads, the management and the players are going to be thinking game by game, but their goal is to win the All-Ireland. It's as simple as that. It has to be, and it is. So if you want to win the All-Ireland in 2021, you couldn't have a better path to Sam Maguire in terms of you're going to get three games in Munster, first of all, instead of two, which is fantastic. Clare are playing very well. They're always a sticky wicket. I do think Fitzgerald Stadium is a factor. Generally, Kerry, I think the last time we played them there, my last year in 2018, I think we scored more than 30 points that day. I think we kicked a huge point total that day. But when we played them in Cusick Park, it's always tough. But after the league they've had, and they've improved again this year, they're going to be a tough game. If you win that, you're away in Semple Stadium to the Munster champions, who've had a bad league campaign and who are going to be very, very anxious to make a big statement that it wasn't a flash in the pan. So that could be a big test. Kerry come through that. You have Cork and Killarney, who beat them last year. So there are three great games. You go to Croke Park, you're playing the Ulster champions. Regardless of who comes out of there, and it's hard to call it, they're going to be well battle-hardened, and that's going to be another test for Kerry. And if then you beat them and you earn the right to be in an All-Ireland final against Dublin from the other side, well, you're well-tested and you're well-ready. So I think from Kerry's perspective, the plan will be to win the All-Ireland. To win the All-Ireland, it's a brilliant route. But, of course, that starts Saturday evening in Killarney, and you have to perform in Killarney against Clare to make sure you get on to the next step.
Absolutely. And while everybody will be well aware of that, my last question will probably undo all of that. Is there a chink in the Dublin armour from what you've seen so far this year?
I don't see them. I think every year since 2016, we've been hoping that there'd be a lessening of the hunger, that there would be signs of decay, but I haven't seen it. I think they went through the league in third gear. They blooded a lot of new players without their manager being at the games with them. They did what they had to do during the league. Can they be beaten? Of course they can. Of course they can. They, you know, they're a brilliant team, but they can be beaten. To beat them, though, you have to get everything right in the day. To beat most teams, you have to get most right, and it'll do you, and you'll get away with a few mistakes. Against Dublin, you have to get almost everything right. And that's possible. A perfect performance is possible. But they still have, you know, as well as all the extra players that they brought through, they still have brilliant man markers in the likes of Fitzsimons, Johnny Cooper. They still have James McCarthy. They still have Fenton. They still have Scully and Kilkenny going very well. They still have Conn O'Callaghan. So all of those players are playing really well. And as long as they have those players, they'll be very hard to stop. They can be stopped, but you have to get everything right.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's going to be a brilliant summer ahead. Just a reminder that Airgrid have announced a 5-year partnership extension for the GAA official timing sponsorship. Airgrid are the state-owned company that manages and develops Ireland's electricity grid to deliver a cleaner energy future. And they're now in their 6th year as the official timing partner of the GAA. And as part of all of that, Eamon Fitzmaurice was speaking to us here on OTBAM. Eamon, great to chat to you as ever. Enjoy the football this weekend.
Thanks, Owen.
OTBAM.
With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors. The OTB Podcast Network with GetZetGo. Black Box Car Insurance lets young drivers bounce past high-cost premiums. Drive safe and save more with GetZetGo.ie.